Hi, my name is Claire and I'm the mother of three teenagers with FASD.
I'm Jessica, a PhD researcher specialising in educational interventions for children with FASD.
And together we are the hosts of Spotlight on FASD, the UK's first podcast dedicated to shining a spotlight on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders.
FASD is a condition caused by prenatal alcohol exposure that affects hundreds of thousands of children across the UK.
And we're here to bring these conversations out of the shadows and make sure that no one living with FASD feels alone.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to the next episode of Spotlight on FASD. I'm by myself this week. Claire is unable to join me, but I am joined again by Jared Brown. We are really, really excited to have Jared on our podcast again to continue the little mini series that we've been doing focusing on criminal justice. If you are following our friends Natalie Vecchione of FASD Hope podcast and Robbie Seal of FASD Family Life podcast, if not, you should go check them out. If you are following them, though, you'll have seen Jared's name appearing there as well. I think between the three of us, we are sapping all of Jared's knowledge and sharing it as far and wide as we possibly can. So we know there is no duplication. So all of these episodes will be really, really valuable to anybody interested in this area. So anybody who wants a little bit more information, definitely check those out. And welcome, Jared. Thank you for coming back.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me back and allowing me to talk about this really important topic.
Yeah, well, I'm really excited. It's, all of these topics are really, really interesting and have a much wider impact than what is first thought. We are loosely relating all of this to criminal justice, but, this goes far beyond. So, this week, we are talking about false confessions, which is, going to be very, very interesting. So, Jared, can you introduce that from your professional perspective, please?
Well, obviously, I think when people hear false confessions, absolutely, you jump to the legal system, the criminal justice arena, which that's where it has the most implications. But if you're working in an education world or a medical field or mental health, social service, if you're working with clients who have a tendency to admit things maybe they didn't do, or maybe they overly admit, or they create false memories, they confabulate, it has significant implications outside the criminal justice arena as well. One thing I do want to say about FASD and false confessions is that there's not a lot of research per se that has looked at false confessions through the lens of FASD. There is tons of research on false confessions in general and with other populations, but empirical-based literature is lacking in the area of FASD. So if you're a researcher or working on a dissertation or whatever, this is a great area, lots of gaps in the literature. But there are enough case studies and professional accounts and caregiver observations and just popular media accounts where they indicate this is a real problem for this population. Why might that be? Obviously, we know the core deficits of FASD, the executive functioning impairments, information processing speed problems, a host of psychiatric co-occurring disorders. So it's very common for people with FASD to have all kinds of co-occurring issues. What about sleep deprivation or attachment problems or like proneness to be suggestible or even compliant with people in positions of power? We know this population is typically going to be more suggestible and gullible and naive compared to the general population. So those are just a few of the variables to keep in mind as to why I believe, and some other people, researchers, clinicians, family members believe that this is a real problem for this population. I know we're going to be talking about victimization and vulnerability in another segment, but this population really has a lot of vulnerability. And at the heart of that, I really think a lot has to do with just their developmental and emotional age, because professionals oftentimes just rely on how old the person is chronologically. But we all know too often that let's say you are working with someone who's 20 years old chronologically who has FASD, they may have a brain or a functioning capability as a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 14-year-old. That is another variable that absolutely needs to be taken into account when we talk about false confessions. What about, let's say you have someone on the spectrum and they're just overly trusting of everybody. That's not a good thing. You have to have some skepticism. Being gullible is the opposite of being skeptical. And a lot of times, at least in my experience too, I do a lot of consultation with caregivers and professionals on these topics. A lot of times people with FASD find themselves involved in the criminal justice system for something in that social realm, social skill limitations, social skill deficits, maybe being talked into doing something by somebody they just met where they're thinking that that person's now their best friend, but that person is really trying to take advantage of them. What happens if someone with FASD has a very low intellectual score as well on top of some of these other deficits? We need to take into account their IQ score, their adaptive functioning. I know we've talked about adaptive functioning in some of our other segments. If you're not familiar with adaptive functioning, a lot of times if, let's say, you're interviewing somebody in a very controlled manner, like it's in an inpatient treatment setting, if the person's in jail or prison, sometimes they can come off maybe just a little more competent than what they are, because if it's in a very predictable, scripted, structured setting, those things can mask deficits as well. We know an FASD brain does not do well with high levels of stress. So being interviewed by a police officer, or if the individual is a defendant in court, all of those things can be stressful, and that can have a negative impact on brain functioning. What about just fatigue in general? Sleep deprivation, fatigue are very common among people with FASD. Fatigue and just not sleeping well has a real impact on our mood, our memory, how we problem solve, how we make decisions. And unfortunately, we know from the research too that a sizable minority of people with FASD may also have some drug and alcohol problems. So what happens if they're using drugs and alcohol on top of a lot of stress? They're sleep deprived, they're dealing with suggestibility. Those are just a few things to consider as to why people with FASD may be more prone to engage in like false confessions and not knowing that they're doing them.
Yeah, and I thought I was thinking then, just as you were talking about how stressful the environment or the situation can be when being interviewed by a police officer or somebody in that kind of situation, and I instantly thought about the environment. Now, fortunately, I can't say I've been in that environment myself, but from what we know, what we see on the television, and what we are aware of, those environments, they tend to have no windows. They tend to be fully closed doors, or just have like a small window in or something. They will be very, very brightly lit from above. You know, the sensory overload of them environment is also going to add to that stress, in addition to this person of authority standing over you, who's, I won't say likely to be unaware. You know, FASD is a hidden disability. Do these police interviews take place before they've explored this individual's background, before they may be aware of any diagnosis that they hold, if the individual has not presented that information willingly themselves? Does the individual even know they have FASD?
Absolutely. You know,
there's so many factors here that can make what would be a stressful situation for anybody far more overwhelming for somebody with processing challenges. In all aspects of the words. And in addition to that, I keep thinking about the expressive language skills,
yes,
of those with FASD. Even if you know FASD and you understand that a 20-year-old may be functioning at, you know, an age more closely related to that of a 10-year-old, a 12, 14-year-old, but their expressive language is actually that of a 22, 23-year-old. Now, that's extremely hard, even if you're experienced in working with individuals with FASD. interacting with them, or you know how to approach these scenarios, or you are very, you know, academically knowledgeable of these situations, actually putting that in practice is extremely challenging. And I know that was one of the early challenges I faced when working with individuals with FASD, because it just messes with your head a bit, doesn't it? Like, you have to keep constantly reminding yourself that although what's coming out of them, or what the feedback that you're receiving for the conversation, is not actually what's going on.
You bring up some wonderful, important points. The sensory component, huge. Mm-hmm. And not all these interviews happen in an office. The interview may happen on the side of the road.
Yes.
Where law enforcement's pulling up, there's lights going, lots of commotion. I mean, that can be overwhelming for anyone, but with someone that has sensory processing, you may see it play out in two ways. They may become very hypo-aroused and shut down and look like they're very tired and sleepy. Or when they're on sensory overload, they can become very hyper-aroused and run away out of fear. A law enforcement officer pulls up on the scene and sees someone running away. Mm-hmm. Obviously, their brain's going to jump to the conclusion that this person has something to hide. Mm-hmm. And that can be a very dangerous combination. Mm-hmm. You also bring up this kind of language. So we have the expressive language. Very important to understand language in this population. Expressive language is typically better than receptive language. Receptive language is how that person with FASD takes in the language during the interview and actually understands and processes it. But I'll take it just a step further with the language. There's something called pragmatic language as well. The use of language in social situations. Mm-hmm. How to greet people. How to do introductions, how to know when to start a conversation, how to know when you're talking to someone versus a stranger versus a friend versus an adult versus a child. So the use of language in social situations can be very challenging for someone with FASD. And again, what happens if the person is very, very impulsive? We know impulsivity is very common in this population. So they may have a real difficult time understanding cause and effect and predicting long-term consequences. They may say everything they think that law enforcement officer wants to hear, thinking that's going to help them get out of that situation and end the interview, when in fact, in some cases, they may have just admitted to something they didn't do. Or maybe they are very susceptible to peer influences and they did do something wrong, but they have a tendency to over-confess, where they take more blame than what they did. Mm-hmm. Because they want other people to like them. So they can, and in other cases, they may have a tendency to want to just really comply with people in a position of power, aka someone in a uniform. So those are some things to keep in mind. What happens if the interview is going on for an extended period of time, so it's very lengthy? That can be very challenging too, because a lot of times, again, the FASD brain has a tendency to get fatigued and shut down and get tired. Prolonged interviews are kind of like situational factors. So we have to look at what's going on within the context of the interview as well. How many people are in the interview at the time? Is there a lot of light? Is there not a lot of light? What's the temperature in the room? What kind of questions are being asked? Are they being phrased in a way that kind of implies guilt too? So the way in which the interviewer is phrasing questions really can have a lot to do with it. And if you look at this literature on false confessions, there's also something called dispositional risk factors. Dispositional risk factors would be like related to like their mental health status. Are they also diagnosed with a whole host of mental health problems? Mm-hmm. What's their cognitive functioning capabilities like? Their executive function, their IQ level. Maybe again, looking at just immaturity in general. Are they cognitively immature, socially, emotionally immature? Those are some dispositional factors you'd want to take into account. And then what happens if the interviewer is using like deceit or trickery or like false ploys, or just really saying, hey, you did this, didn't you? And just really pushing. And then that eventually gets that person to shift from a point of saying, no, I had nothing to do with it, to then confessing, which then could be a factor, obviously leading to a false confession. So lots of factors to take into account, lots of variables. I mentioned confabulation. I think that's a huge one to be aware of. That's false memory creation, where the person believes what they're saying to be true, but it's either a complete lie or it's taken out of temporal context, where maybe what they're admitting to happened 10 years ago, but in their mind, maybe they're admitting it from this morning. Confusion is another variable. If they're confused, confusion is a recipe for disaster in these kind of situations. So lots of variables, a lot of things to take into account. And the topic of uncertainty too has to be considered. If that person goes into an interview and is just very uncertain, has a lot of self-doubt, is confused, is fatigued, sleep deprived, sensory overload, you can about imagine how successful they'll be being interviewed for, even if it's a witness. This has to be taken into account. If someone with FASD is a witness to a crime, we have to consider these variables as well, I think.
Definitely. And the stress of witnessing that, and especially if it's a peer who, you know, they are wanting to please. If they have those social challenges, it's not necessarily a friend, it's not necessarily somebody that they have a relationship with, but it's somebody that they want to please. And, you know, there's all these factors. And the short-term memory problems as well. If these interviews are being, you know, conducted fairly soon after an event, when those stress levels are still really, really high, the individual's not being given a chance to calm down from that situation, and then also start processing the memories, but processing them in a way that allows them to correctly piece together what actually happened. And I think that's when confabulation, and Claire and I did an episode on confabulation, so I'll link or do whatever you do on. Yeah. We'll leave the information for the confabulation episode somewhere. You know, that's really going to come into it when you're desperately trying to scramble, you know, this memory together under pressure. And, you know, I know that we're having a very professional and quite academic conversation here, you know, with all these terms and things, but I can't stop. I keep thinking about a particular Netflix series, and I don't know if you will have seen it, Jared, but many people across the world have. It's 5 or 6 years ago, and you know, Netflix and their true crime, and we've all, you know, they've done plenty, but this particular series, there was an episode that focused on a police interview of a young guy who was just a teenager. They went into a school and pulled him aside for questioning. And this questioning took place in school. And he was sat in a chair. So he pulled from class, sat in a chair, and these two police officers that were, you know, very big, you know, have all their uniform on, had a real presence about them, you know, just as individuals. They were in that position of authority. And I've never, ever been able to forget my reaction when I watched this episode of how the interview was conducted with this individual and the individual's reaction to that. Now, I have no knowledge or expertise or anything around what the laws are and, you know, whether they were in any wrongdoing with how they approached that. But for me, from working with a neurodiverse population, and seeing this individual struggle in the way he did, and how these false confessions were so apparent in this interview based on the way that the questions were presented, has really stuck with me. And, you know, I have seen it in other episodes. It's Netflix. I don't know how much of this has been dramatized, and, you know, clever editing and everything else. But you know, you do see these things play out in various ways. And it just shows for me how there is a severe lack of understanding around how to approach not just individuals with FASD, but probably everybody.
On some level, I think we're all prone to falsely confessing.
Yeah.
But if you have a neurodevelopmental disorder, various neurocognitive impairments, you have a personality of wanting to always people please, and maybe it's gaining a sense of belonging, and you have a real hard time dealing with stress.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you have a lower IQ. You brought up memory. Again, short-term memory, long-term memory, working memory. High anxiety is a factor for some. What happens if you go into the interview and you have a very low self-esteem? Self-esteem has been studied within the context of some of these things we're talking about. Maybe not FASD per se, but false confessions in general. Maybe you're a person who doesn't trust your memory in general, so you're more likely to go along with what other people say because you just lack the confidence in your own memory capabilities. There's something called memory distrust that's actually in the research literature.
Okay.
Difficulty understanding like social situations. Again, a pragmatic language, at lower levels of adaptive functioning, even having a higher trauma history, higher levels of having a negative life experience can be a factor in some of these cases. And I brought up compliance a little bit. There is some research to support the fact too that people with insecure attachment patterns may be more likely to be compliant than people with secure attachment. So there's just so many different variables to take into account when we talk about these things. Mm-hmm. Compliance, suggestibility, confabulation, naivete, just understanding abstract reasoning. We know that's a huge issue for this population, linking cause and effect, planning for the future. Mm-hmm. Those abstract concepts are very challenging. And sometimes the vocabulary and the phrases that are used in the criminal justice system can be very confusing for someone with FASD. So you always want to fact check. You want to verify. You don't want to always rely on, if you're interviewing someone with FASD, the verbal head nod, yep, I get it, or no, I don't. Fact check, verify, have them repeat back to you in their own words. I think it's important to get as much training on these topics as possible. Even if you're not interviewing someone with FASD and you really start developing an expertise in all of these different areas, I think that's going to come in handy with anyone that you interview. So definitely seek out more training, more consultation, staying current on this literature. It's very important. I think it can result in much better outcomes for all folks involved.
Yeah, definitely. So it's something very difficult to suggest achievable adjustments for, really, beyond every individual educating themselves as much as possible with the literature that is there. But as you say, the literature itself is still limited. And then piecing it together, I've been editing my PhD this week, actually. And something that I focused on in one of my chapters is the disconnect between the lived experience and the literature. And my first interaction that I knew of anyway with an individual with FASD came 2.5 years after I began my PhD. I was 2.5 years into the literature, the academic study. And when I met these individuals, none of it tied together.
No.
None of it at all. And at no point was I able to place what I had learned from the literature into these scenarios to see how it was presenting in front of me and how it was unfolding. Because when you're met with a hidden disability, and in that moment, the individual is masking because they've just met somebody new, and everything is very normal and very calm, and nothing has happened yet. There's nothing to suggest that they have a disability at all. It's all of these things that we've discussed just go around in your head, and you're like, well, do you have executive functioning deficits? Do you have expressive language? You know, it's so confusing because of it being such a hidden disability, and of being as a society being so unaware of it whilst growing up. And I think something that was very important for me to do, and then what I later trained others in doing, is like retraining your own thinking and all of your societal expectations that you have been raised with, and just pushing them aside. Because great, until you know,
very important reminders, absolutely.
It's so confusing.
It is, and I'll leave your audience with this and really piggyback off what you're saying. Why is this so confusing? Because cognitive challenges are the hallmark for FASD, so those executive functioning impairments, the abstract reasoning deficits, lower levels of IQ, or maybe it's an average IQ, but lower levels of adaptive functioning. That's very confusing. Information processing and auditory processing speed weaknesses. So if you're interviewing someone and they start shutting down, maybe they're only picking up every third word you're saying. So they're having a hard time piecing together what's being said. If the individual has a speech, language, or communication disorder or deficits or comprehension issues, they just have a real hard time comprehend verbal information. I give a lot of talks on social cognition. Have to understand social cognition. That's kind of that umbrella term for just how the person understands the social world. Under that umbrella, you're going to have topics like empathy, mentalization, moral reasoning, theory of mind, the social vulnerability piece, which we'll talk about in another segment, just choice-making deficits, humor-making deficits. Maybe they have a tendency to perseverate or ruminate, or there's some self-regulation issues, or lower levels of problem solving, decision making. You mentioned the sensory component. What happens if the person's asked to fill out a form and they have some reading or writing or vocabulary deficits? Extreme stress, we have to be aware of that. Confusion, suggestibility, compliance, naivete. Those are just some of the main variables to take into account. Some people with FASD may be dealing with only some of those. Other people may be dealing with all of those. So you really have to get to know that person too. They may function better in the morning versus the night because of sleep problems. They may function better when there's one person in the room versus two. Maybe they do better with the lights dim versus high. Maybe they do better going for a walk and doing an interview if possible, because they just have a hard time sitting still because they're diagnosed with ADHD on top of FASD. So many variables to take into account, but hopefully this has planted the seeds for your audience that there's a lot of complexities to this and really to dig deeper.
Yeah, so that's hugely beneficial and a real body of information there for professionals. And I'm going to put you on the spot here, and I apologize, but it's just come to mind.
Yes.
Would you have any advice for parents or carers who are in the position of their child, maybe an adult child, being in this situation?
I get emails from caregivers all the time about the same thing, that my child or my adult now is involved in the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. They are going through the court process. My advice, if somebody is involved in the criminal justice system, hire an expert, hire a consultant who really can educate the courts and the attorneys about FASD. Now, we want to prevent this from happening in the first place, obviously, before they get into contact with them. Providing those supports, early intervention, forming a multidisciplinary team, getting the schools more educated, case managers, therapists, medical doctors. If the person is dealing with sleep issues, work with a sleep specialist. If they're dealing with sensory processing issues, work with a sensory processing specialist. If they're dealing with a speech language communication issue, work with a speech language pathologist. Mm-hmm. If they're dealing with some social skill deficits, maybe it's some social skills training by a skills worker, an in-home worker, or some sort of group they can join. forming a multidisciplinary team who truly understands FASD is very important. In the community you live in, reaching out to law enforcement, getting them involved in trainings, getting law enforcement as much training on these topics as possible. Where I'm at, a lot of the law enforcement departments now are getting more and more training on autism. But I really think too, obviously learning about autism is very important, learning about ADHD, brain injuries. But when you're learning about those topics too, learn about FASD. We know the rates of FASD are significantly higher than autism in the general population, at least in the United States. So I think seeking out training, reaching out, forming connections with law enforcement, forming connections with mental health, getting everyone in the room and cross-training everyone is very, very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So things I would recommend.
Yeah, so basically bring in the professionals and surround yourself with that network. And hopefully, and before it gets to the point of involvement in the system, make a presence, a positive presence within your community, and you know, make yourself known on better terms to local law enforcement. Explain the situation. I was just reminded there, I met a carer once who told me that they'd had some issues the day before with law enforcement, with his teenager, who had rang the police and said, you know, he's my dad's being abused. So making these false confessions, but actually seeking the police out. You know, my dad's been abusing me. He beat me up outside the house and he smashed my head into the sidewalk outside our home. And this story went on. So luckily, because this parent had already made himself known to local law enforcement, they called him and said, you know, can we come down for a chat? We have to investigate this call that's just come in. And he said, yeah, sure. I'll be free in, you know, 10, 15 minutes. Meet me on the sidewalk outside my house. So the same sidewalk where this incident had taken place. So the police officer arrived at the house, knocked on the door, and he said, you don't have a sidewalk outside your house. He's like, nah-huh. Yep. And there is the first sign of what's going on here. And you can just imagine how differently that scenario could have gone had that parent not made those connections in the early days. That could have been extremely stressful for everybody involved. That could have been leading to arrests and just unimaginable, really, compared to how it did play out. So you know, I think it's really important to have built that relationship, as you say, and have them trained if possible, but if not, have that knowledge at least to have a foundation on, so that nobody's jumping to conclusions, nobody's, you know, grabbing for the handcuffs straight away and all of the blue lights and everything that comes with these more extreme scenarios. So yeah, that's a really, really interesting, really great conversation as always. And I think we should end this here, but as always, if anybody wants to get in touch, anybody has any questions or anything, please feel free to do so. Just lots and lots to process and think about there.
Thank you for all your insights too. Very helpful. And have your audience reach out anytime if they have questions. I always get back to emails right away.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Jared. And yeah, we will see you again in our next episode. Thank you everyone for listening and goodbye.
Thank you.